This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I said just a few days ago that, you know, it felt like the libertarian movement is a little quiet in this presidential election. And maybe our guest is going to tell me that's unfair. But Kevin Wilson's been on this program a number of times. He's the former chair of the Libertarian Party of Monroe County. And he, you know, he's a radio host himself. Yeah, good to see you back here, by the way.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me back. It's fun talking to you.
Where do people find your work now, Kevin Wilson?
So you can always find me on Twitter at Kevin Wilson RRC. And you know, I'm a host of a show called A Free Solution, where we're on Thursdays at 8 p.m. And, you know, we talk libertarian politics.
And so, was I wrong a few days ago when I said, you know, where are the libertarians this time around? Does it seem quieter?
There is certainly less media coverage this time around. There is a presidential candidate from the Libertarian Party. His name is Chase Oliver, and he's running with a fellow named Mike Tremont. And they are on the ballot in 47 states. Now, New York State, for reasons maybe we get into, he is not going to be on the ballot here. But you can write in Chase Oliver for president. We'll talk about, I assume, the why I'm voting for him. But he is on the ballot. He's around. And, you know, if you're looking for an alternative to the Democrat and Republican choices this year, then there is an option in 47 states. Plus, you can write in New York.
It was in 2016 that the Libertarians got 3.3% of the national vote, 4.5 million votes for Gary Johnson and Bill Weld in 2016. It was the second presidential candidacy for the former Arizona governor, New Mexico governor. Thank you, Gary Johnson. And you know, he was a pretty commonly known figure. He had been a governor, and you know, 4.5 million votes is a lot of votes. It looked like the Libertarian Party was on the ascent. Joe Jorgensen 4 years ago didn't do as well, but you know, still eclipsed something around 1.5%, you know, over 1 million votes. And so now I don't know what Chase Oliver ends up with. I don't know how you don't end up on the ballot in New York State. You want to mention?
Yeah, let's talk about that first, because that change happened thanks to Governor Cuomo under the guise of campaign finance reform. It is essentially the argument went like, well, we're going to be giving some money to candidates and we want to make sure they're qualified. So we're going to increase the burden to get on the ballot, even though there are still additional qualifications, even if you are a candidate on the ballot, in order to get matching funds from the state. So for statewide elections, you need to get 45,000. Valid signatures from registered voters. It used to be 15,000, so they tripled the requirement to get on for statewide ballots. And when you get 45,000 valid signatures, that really means you need probably close to double that, because the Republicans and Democrats will challenge the validity of those signatures. If something, they can't quite read a name, or the address looks off, or they write that they live in Rochester, but they're actually in Penfield with a Rochester address, like it's all these things can knock signatures off the ballot. And so this year, the New York State Libertarian Party was not able to overcome that barrier. They also weren't able to overcome it in 2022 when Larry Sharp was running for governor again. And this has made it difficult for New Yorkers to have other choices on the ballot every election season.
And let me just put a fine point on what Kevin said there. Everything that I have been able to find out talking to people who worked, even who worked around then-Governor Andrew Cuomo, Kevin's right. The actual intention of the change in this rule that happened under Cuomo was to make it harder for quote-unquote third parties to get candidates on ballots. And in some ways, that was targeting the Working Families Party, who Cuomo has had all kinds of issues with. But it has affected others. I mean, the reason that Jill Stein came on Connections earlier this year, she was in Rochester trying to generate signatures to get on the ballot as a Green Party presidential candidate. So I think Kevin's correct. And the result is, in this case, you don't have the Libertarian on the ballot, but his name is Chase Oliver, 39-year-old Libertarian activist living in Atlanta. What do you want listeners to know about Chase Oliver?
So I want you to know, first of all, that there is an alternative. If you watched the vice presidential debate last night, or the two previous presidential debates, know that there are other folks running for president that are worth your consideration. And the other thing is that, you know, he's run for office before. You know, he ran in the Georgia Senate race and enforced a runoff in that race. And one of the important things is that if you value issues that aren't being spoken to by the national parties like I do, then like this is a way to bring attention to the issues that are being ignored by the major two candidates. And like to that end, Joe Jorgensen had split the difference in some states in the 2020 election. And that forces Donald Trump and, you know, now Kamala Harris to speak to some of the issues that voters who've decided that they're not dealing with either candidate need to address. You know, and that could be things like economic issues that are going unaddressed, tariffs, immigration, the national debt. All these things are things worth considering that I think aren't getting enough discussion, certainly in the direction that a lot of middle-of-the-road voters are looking for in the national conversation.
Dallas writes to say, the Libertarian Party is quiet, Evan. Quiet as in the same kind of quiet as Kamala, don't interview me, bro, Harris. Come on. And Dallas says, come on, I'm funny. Okay, that's a little funny, Dallas. I do think every candidate should do more interviews. Vice President Harris would be welcome on this program. I would love to see that. But I also think there is a larger point in that I don't think the media has always covered non-Republicans and Democrats extensively or fairly. Or the way that they should be covered. That's why we try to cover them if they're on the ballot here. That's why I was surprised Chase Oliver wasn't, but now you know why Chase Oliver is not. So if there doesn't feel like there's as much buzz this year, that could be one of the reasons, and it might not be the Libertarians' fault. But how do you rank Oliver in the realm of recent presidential candidates? Jorgensen, Gary Johnson, Badnarik, everybody who's been on the ballot in this century. How does Chase Oliver rank for you?
You're going to make me rank. I love all of them. That's nice. I mean, obviously, like Chase isn't a former governor, but he does bring a couple of interesting perspectives. And you know, there was a very contentious Libertarian primary, which is played out at the National Convention. It came right down to the final vote. And he ended up pulling off, which I was thrilled to see because he was my favorite candidate in the primary. But, you know, but he's a younger guy. Again, being 39 years old, he brings that perspective. He brings like a long-term vision for what he wants to do. It's not just short-term thinking, you know, not trying to get to the next election, the next re-election. It's thinking about things long-term. And he brings that, you know, that different approach. In this case, he's coming. He was a Democrat. He was an Obama Democrat. And he kind of heard about the Libertarian Party at a Pride Festival in Atlanta. He was coming at this from an anti-war perspective, which is another thing that he brings to the table. Is, you know, if you heard the vice presidential debate last night, it's, you know, a scramble to see who could support giving more weapons to Israel faster, right? Like, which is, you know, fine, that is a valid position, but there's not much discussion at that level. Like, hey, is this strategically important for the United States to be doing? Is it morally acceptable for the United States to be taking that position of funding the Israeli military or talking about Ukraine, things like that? He's bringing those issues to the table. Like, is this actually in the best interest to be spending this money and to take these positions to support these countries long term?
All right. So, Kevin, tell listeners then, when you look at the issues, issue by issue, what should pop to voters who really feel like, hey, Republicans and Democrats are, those are the choices. It's a binary. They're different enough. What makes Libertarians stand out on the issues? Kind of, if you want to go down some of the list here.
Sure. So one's the war issue that I just mentioned. You know, again, Chase Oliver's having these conversations of like, hey, let's have a serious consideration about the U.S.'s role in the rest of the world. Is it strategically important for us to be involved in these places, or would it be helpful in the long term, not just for the U.S., but for these other countries to take a step back and allow them to have their own leadership in these situations? You know, you can disagree, but like, he's having that conversation and pushing that forward. The other thing is tariffs. I'm glad the Harris campaign has started to like walk back tariffs, but frankly, the Biden administration has kept the tariffs in place that were imposed under the Trump administration under dubious national security justification, and expanded them in some ways. And the Chase Oliver campaign has correctly noted that tariffs are just a tax on the American people. And I'm shocked when I talk to Republican candidates where they're like, "Yeah, we want to add a tariff to local to foreign imported food." I'm like, you're going to make my grocery bill more expensive. You're complaining about inflation, which is a totally valid issue, but then you're going to make my grocery bill more expensive by taxing foreign food. And like, oh, it's a tariff. No, it's a tax. That's what it is. It's a tax on stuff that comes in. We as a consumer pay that. And the Chase Oliver campaign is correctly noted, like, hey, we shouldn't be doing that. We should make it as easy as possible for goods to move in and out. And especially in the cases of food, there's not a valid national security reason to impose that. And hopefully there's more conversation happening in terms of having Congress take back that power to be able to impose tariffs on the American people.
I want to get back to a couple of other issues, but let me stay on the subject of tariffs for a moment.
Yeah.
Donald Trump has said that he's going to be able to provide essentially free childcare for all Americans by cranking up tariffs on China to unprecedented levels. And every economist's head in the country sort of flew off their sockets. But last night, J.D. Vance said, well, you know, who are you going to trust? Economists, they're just eggheads. You know, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what your life is like as real American people. They live in the ivory tower. And he's appealing to an American electorate that is increasingly suspicious of expertise, of authority. And Vance is saying, we have to get tough on China. Let's do it. Let's crank those tariffs even higher. And then let's take that revenue and then let's give it for free childcare. What do you think?
I think that's not going to work. The economists are going to be right on this one. And I recognize like the populist element, like, hey, we've been listening to the experts for so long. Well, I mean, as like a libertarian on the economic side, I don't think so. But so like in this case, right, like if you are imposing a punitive tariff on China, like the goal of that, like if that's a goal, is usually we want to have Americans buying fewer Chinese goods so that American manufacturers can do this. And you might do that for like the chips industry or steel production, whatever. Right. Not saying I'm justifying. That's why you normally do that. If it works successfully, you will not collect that much revenue from it because people won't be buying it, because the cost is prohibitive. So that's not a realistic mechanism for funding the government. What would probably end up happening is we're going to have these tariffs. We're going to say it's going to pay for childcare. They're not going to collect as much revenue as anticipated. And then we're just going to add the more debt for whatever childcare program ends up coming out of the Trump administration.
But the criticism, I think, of the libertarian perspective here is that if you take away all sort of, whether it's tariffs or all mechanisms to try to enforce standards, regulations, et cetera, then you're left with a massive trade deficit and we lose the manufacturing that we've lost and more. And is there a realistic plan under a libertarian administration to bring back manufacturing and making goods here?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things that we could do in terms of bringing back manufacturing is, and I'm glad to see some of the Democrats starting to talk about this too, like when they talk about like an abundance agenda approach, is things like permitting reform, right? Okay, like why is it so difficult for us to build darn near anything? Like the CHIPS Act, so much of that money went towards just trying to get the environmental permits to build like and expand the factories in terms of the CHIPS Act stuff and to comply with all the regulations that are built on it. Like we're spending so much money on self-imposed burdens that aren't necessary. So, okay, so the libertarian plan is things like the NEPA reform, the National Environmental Protection Act. So making it easier to build things like nuclear power, making it easier to build things like solar and wind, even things like private high-speed rail too. Like why is California taking so long? A lot of it is environmental review. It's taking forever and costing billions and billions of dollars. So like we're getting neither, right? Like Joe Biden and Harris can talk about like, oh, we're spending all this money and investing in all this money to build out infrastructure and green energy and blah, blah, blah. But like half of that is just going into the hands of bureaucrats, like talking about compliance. That's an insane way to approach the building of infrastructure. And again, I'm glad Democrats are starting to have that conversation around that. But the libertarians have been talking about this forever. When we talk about like regulation getting in the way of building housing, energy, manufacturing, this is the type of stuff that we've been talking about for a while. And the good thing is I think there's starting to be some influence on the conversation at the national level.
Both candidates last night, both candidates at the top of the ticket have talked about expanding a child tax credit. I don't know if this is in the libertarian playbook, but let me also just broaden it out. I want to talk a little bit about what you think the government should be funding. So Let's start with the child tax credit. Am I correct to assume that this is not in the libertarian playbook?
No. I mean, the libertarian approach to taxation is like, obviously, we want lower taxes. That's on brand. But like, I would say generally the approach is try to simplify taxes as much as possible. Right. So like right now we have a tax structure, like including things that like seem nice, like the child tax credit, things that I would personally benefit from, too. I have two kids, but like, you should be able to do taxes on the back of a note card. It should be relatively simple. You know, we could even have a very simple, clear, progressive taxation still. Now, I'll concede that. And it should be done in minutes, not something that takes you hours to do. And you can't, you know, you have to hire an expert to be able to be in compliance. That's, you know, the expansion of the IRS to be able to do that has ended up with a lot of middle class families getting audits. It didn't just go towards the rich. It ended up, because we have such a complex tax system, it ends up hurting families both in the time they need to spend submitting their taxes, the time they need to spend complying with audits, and what ends up happening is the people who have the resources to be able to find the loopholes and to get the tax, the different tax credits that are available to people, end up benefiting. Those people end up tending to be wealthier. So if you want to help the working class, you want to help the middle class in terms of taxation, make things simpler. That's the platform. Make it simpler. Make it clear. You should be able to do that in minutes. The IRS could just like send you, they know what you owe. They could just send you what you owe and that's it. It could be nice and simple. But instead, we have a complicated system that ends up being expensive for everybody.
Okay, so no child tax credit, too complicated, et cetera. What is the libertarian approach to helping children get out of poverty? We got millions of children in poverty in this country.
Yeah, I mean, and there are some things like there's, I think it came out of Milton Friedman, the earned income tax credit is mm-hmm. actually like a decent way of, it's not quite a negative income tax, but that's something that I'm open to. Like, again, I'm not speaking for the entire libertarian party at this point.
I understand,
but,
yep.
No, the earned income tax credit is one way to do that. And the other way to do that is, again, just to, you know, make it easier for people to get jobs. That permitting reform stuff, you know, down from individual entrepreneurs to bigger projects, making it easier for people to get jobs, not doubling down on the national debt too, because that's something that's going to affect children long term. And, you know, we can talk about expanding educational choices and options as well.
Well, the libertarian platform includes abolishing the Department of Education, right?
It does. It does. And
what would be the result of that?
The result of that is that new organizations would form to improve education at the national level, right? Like that the Department of Education could function as but the alternative to that could function as a clearinghouse for education best practices. A lot of education is left to the state. It ends up being block grants. And then, you know, of course, a massive amount of compliance that needs to go along with that. Like, let states figure out the education stuff and figure out what works best, because a lot of times when you get federal money, it comes with so many strings attached that ends up becoming problematic. And I think you've had like Phil Rickey on in the past, too, who's also from the Libertarian Party. You talked about that at the school board level.
And the first minute of the show next hour is going to sound like an ad for the Libertarian Party, because the new FAFSA rollout has been such a disaster at the federal level. And we're going to talk about, you know, some of the results of that and then what different organizations are doing to help students who couldn't even get forms in on time to get financial aid this year.
Total disaster this year in terms of like the federal rollout. And like, frankly, the student loan program creates a lot of bad incentives too. Like, again, it's a well-intentioned program. I understand that. Like, it's a well-intentioned program. I use student loans. I still have student loans. But it's a program that incentivizes colleges not to control costs. And they end up raising costs and adding more amenities to meet the amount of federal aid and student loan dollars that students can get. So it creates a lot of moral hazard by having such a robust federal program that ends up trapping students in a lot of debt.
Should we have a Social Security program?
I think that I wish the candidates would talk more about Social Security, because we are fast approaching insolvency on Social Security. To me, again, speaking for myself, like, I would love to see something more akin to a program where you're able to just divert everything to a 401k type of program. Like, I'm not really expecting like the full Social Security benefits. You know, me at 34 years old, I'm not really expecting that, given the lack of seriousness at a national level. Again, no discussion of this in either debate, like the solvency of Social Security. It's going to be out. Benefits are going to be automatically cut just a few years from now. And we're not talking about it. No one's serious about getting it done. And no one's going to do anything until, you know, we actually have a crisis. So again, the alternative to that is doing things like what Australia did, which is say, okay, we're going to devolve this, Social Security system and their equivalent of that, and have everyone have their own individual investment accounts that, you know, even if there's a requirement, I think you owning your own money is going to be a better, more stable alternative for most Americans than Social Security is now.
Talking to Kevin Wilson, the former chair of the Libertarian Party of Monroe County, what would you say to a voter who might be sort of a on the old typical paradigm? I don't even know where the paradigm is anymore. But let's say old center right, a John McCain Republican who has voted libertarian at times, but says, "I'm going to vote for the Democratic ticket in this election because we have, for the first time in our history in 2020, we had a president refuse the peaceful transition of power." And we have a vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket who says that had he been in Mike Pence's role, he would have brought in new electors to flip the results illegitimately.
Yeah.
And that is a crisis. And so I'm going to vote for the Democrats this year. What would you say to that person?
So that's a totally fair criticism of Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, and I have that same criticism. That said, the Biden administration, and I think Harris and Walz would do something similar, they violate constitutional norms in more polite ways. You know, an example of that would be student loans, where the Biden administration just went ahead and, like, they twisted some old legislation to try to push student loan forgiveness, knowing darn well that it wasn't constitutional. It's an exercise in the politics of power. And I think the Democrats need to not lose sight. Just because the Republicans are doing, like, shady stuff and they're engaging in illiberalism doesn't mean that Democrats ought to do the same thing. So when Democrats are engaging in the politics of power, when they're engaging of a, well, we won the election, so we get to do what we want, that is a dangerous road that leads to, like, the erosion of the Constitution, the erosion of law and order, and they need to be held accountable to that. So if they aren't going to fix that stuff, then they don't deserve my vote either.
What should the United States do vis-a-vis Ukraine?
Great question. In terms of Ukraine, I'm very sympathetic to the cause. You know, say that Chase Oliver and Mike Tremat are skeptical that the long-term solution is endless funding of weapons, and that there is a risk in doing so of escalation of war between the United States and Russia, and that the consequences of that are far too high. And I say that as someone who's, like, very sympathetic to the Ukrainian cause. They were invaded by an aggressor, and I understand why people want to help them. But at the same time, we have to consider what are the long-term consequences for the United States, for Europe, a prolonged war in Ukraine that, you know, are we able to – if we're not able to fund them sufficiently to have a decisive victory over the next 5 years, if it results in the deaths of – hundreds of thousands of more people, and we end up in the exact same place, was that worth the billions and billions of dollars that we're going to spend on that? And, you know, the further deterioration of relationships between, you know, the United States and Russia.
Here's where I think the Libertarian Party is doing a really important service on issues like this. The Republican Party's language, if you read it, and then I just sent you what Russia Today or different Russian networks, it is very, very close to the same. It's why the Russian government spent, what, $10 million to fund Tim Pool and Dave Rubin and these American podcasters who didn't even know they were being funded by the Kremlin, because they were essentially just parroting Kremlin lines. And they're blaming Ukraine for this invasion. They're blaming the Ukrainian people. They're mocking the Ukrainian people. Trump has done the same.
Yeah.
What the Libertarian Party is doing is saying, we are sympathetic to how horrible this is.
Mm-hmm.
However, what risk are we willing to take to come closer to nuclear war, which could be worldwide catastrophic? What does victory or winning look like? And what's the realistic chance that we're going to spend another 5-10 years sending more weapons and seeing a lot more people die with no change?
Yeah.
Those are fair and important questions. And I think that there aren't a whole lot of people engaging in quite that way on the national scene.
No. Again, the conversation is usually like, we've got to support democracy in Ukraine, end of story, so whatever it takes. And I think that's almost a direct quote from
Or it's like, or, well, no, it's like Zelensky's corrupt and it was their fault anyway, and who can blame Putin? I mean, like, it's really remarkable.
You know, and that sort of discussion is frustrating to me, too. Like, oh, like, they invaded because Ukraine was maybe going to join NATO. I'm like, no, they shouldn't have done that. They're the aggressor. They're wrong here. And again, I'm sympathetic to, like, the cause of the Ukrainian people, but, like, again, we have to consider, like, what does victory look like for us, and what risks are we taking by continuing to engage in this way?
All right, last minute. What do you want to leave with listeners when you think about libertarian politics going forward, not just on the national scene, but where this party goes next?
So, again, I'm hoping that the party is going to be able to recover from the damage done by Andrew Cuomo's ballot stuff in New York State. But if you want to consider an alternative that respects the rule of law, that respects constitutionalism, that respects, like, the broad sense of liberalism, the Libertarian Party is really the only one, like, fully engaging in that. The Democrats and Republicans need to be held accountable for their lack of liberalism, of law and order, or law, rule of law, and respecting the Constitution. And if you want someone who's serious about debt, immigration, anti-war issues, and the economy, then you need to go check out Chase Oliver and Mike Tremat, the Libertarian candidates for president.
We didn't even get to immigration in Springfield, Ohio. That's like a whole other conversation.
Oh,
Kevin.
Yeah. Now, you'd have to have me on for a whole other hour for that.
I think it's been too long. I think we should do this. And I think I need to talk to Phil Rickey and others like him. It's been a little while here. And that's the fault of the host. It's a busy year here. You know, we only get about 400 hours a year. Kevin Wilson's the former chair of the Libertarian Party of Monroe County. And where can people, again, hear you on a regular basis, Kevin?
Go look for me on Twitter, at Kevin Wilson Rock. I also have a Facebook page, Kevin Wilson Libertarian. Or look up A Free Solution. We're available wherever you can find podcasts.
Thank you for being here, as always.
Thank you for having me.
More connections coming up.